Find all your 4th of July needs at low prices. All in the Kroger app. Get USDA Choice bone-in tender ribeye steaks for $7.99 a pound with a digital coupon. Limit 5. Then buy 2, get 3 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, hey, folks. You are back with Aggo and Woody on the WOW. This is Monday, July 1st,
2024. July 1st. Dead of summer, right?
I can't. Hot. This year is just it's half the year. Boom. Over.
Hot. Yeah, that's true. It's flown by. And hot. Hope everybody's having a good time and on your vacations and all that good shit. Listening to the WOW. We love and appreciate each and every one of y'all. And yeah, thanks for listening. The numbers don't lie, right?
Woody, this hot sticky shit, it gets a really bad rap out there. But having lived through summers in the valley in Southern California where the temperature gets 110, 112, 114, and you know, the word is, well, it's a dry heat. It's
still fucking hot.
I mean, it's hotter than hell. Yeah. I mean, you don't sweat that much because right. It evaporates before, but given a choice between the two, because I would go out and take lengthy bike rides out there in the 100+ weather. And I take lengthy bike rides here in the weather we're having right now. I much prefer doing it here. You're number one, you're burning more calories sweating out more. But the air is more breathable.
Yeah.
I think the humidity thing versus the zero humidity thing gets a bad rap. I think the desert people have done better PR than the people living in humidity.
Yeah. Let me tell you, and I think it was 94, I moved to Salt Lake City. It was during July. And when work was shut down or turn around at Chevron, stay there like through October. But I had a 1986 Cadillac and it still had cassette players in it. It was like 114 fucking degrees in the parking lot. And I left cassettes on the dash and they melted. I've never had anything melt on my dash in Louisiana. And it was so hot that you're right. You didn't sweat. As soon as it hit your sweat came out, it was salt. You could take your hand and wipe, get a handful of salt. So hot is fucking hot, but it's hot in Louisiana right now. In fact, this past weekend and today in New Orleans, it's supposed to feel like over 114 with the humidity. Now that's the only difference. I tell you and in Utah, you can get in the shade of a tree and it's much cooler. In Louisiana, you get in the shade of a tree, your fucking ass is just as hot as if you're sitting in the sun almost. It's no, that part is for real. And I think the humidity just takes some getting used to, you know, but hot is hot, right?
Yeah. But you know, out there, there's never a storm that's going to come through that's going to cool things off and then the sun's going to come back out. I was out for a bike ride on Thursday and the sky opened up just immediately. And I mean, I got drenched, but it lasted 20 minutes. It was completely refreshing. I don't care. I don't mind riding the bike while I'm wet. It actually felt great. There's no such relief coming if you're out on a bike ride in Phoenix or in Nevada somewhere or one of the valleys in California that time of year. So
the difference
climate is growing on me.
The difference here is usually we'll have that afternoon thunderstorm come through. If it's, you know, it'd be 100 degrees, heat index of 114, and it comes through and it rains just enough. Not enough to really soak anything and cool it down. It rains enough to make it steam. And then you're really fucking hot. It's like being in a sauna. So, but it is what it is. And you're in the concrete jungle down there. Yeah. Yeah.
We all definitely sweat more. I'm definitely sweating a lot more, doing a lot more laundry than I used to have to do in California. But anyway, hey, I've got a first story that I want you to, it's pretty sad. I want you to bow your head and folks, I want you to please join and bow your head in a moment of silence for this story.
All right.
Thank you. We've had many, many heartbreaking stories we've had to report on The Daily Show and Real Life, Real Crime and already on The Wow. But this one is particularly painful. An iconic American institution has announced that due to the economic downturn, it has no choice but to close 40 of its store locations. That's right, folks. That iconic logo with the owl and those thick orange letters, as American as apple pie, has been plucked by the talons of inflation. A spokesperson from Hooters spoke to the New York Post saying, quote, like many restaurants, under pressure from current market conditions, Hooters has made the difficult decision to shut down 40 of our restaurants. Approximately 40 of Hooters' 300 restaurants are being closed. The company blames inflation, the high cost of living, and the post-coronavirus lockdown landscape for making it difficult for restaurants in America to survive. Data from the third quarter of 2023 shows that visits to full-service restaurants across the country were down nearly 5% from 2022. For Hooters and other restaurants, costs have increased as much as 20% over the past 4 years, and they have no choice but to pass those costs on to their diners. So despite the quality food, great atmosphere, and the fine hostesses, steep price increases have forced customers to stay away. Woody, I'm hoping that the Denham Springs location was not a victim of those latest shutdowns.
It hasn't been so far, but let me tell you this. The back before Sydney, when I was a cop, I had never gone to Hooters. And all my buddies would go, and I went one time for my buddy Ben Smith, who was over at Motor Patrol and all that. He's deceased now. He got killed. But the I went one time. And with them, a bunch of cops at the table, and you know, the beer's ice cold. I love a good chicken wing. And then when Sid and I got together, we started going and just hanging out, you know, doing a little day drinking and doing work at the table and all that stuff. But the one thing about, except for the one in Washington, D.C., that's close to Chinatown, I've been, you know, I travel the country. I would always find a Hooters or what's the other one? Fuck Buffalo Wild. I don't even like that place. The one where they Twin Peaks, where they wear the lumberjack.
Oh, I don't know that. I don't know that place.
Okay. Twin Peaks is fucking the jam too. And their wings are fire, and they got millionaires bacon and all that. But and their beer is so cold, it shows on the sign how cold it is. They have hot mugs, and they pour the beer, and it freezes the mug. But back to it. Normally, if I go out of town with my family for wherever, I don't go to a national chain restaurant. We try local places, except for when I was traveling by myself. I knew I could go into a Hooters and get consistent, good wings and cold beer, except for that shitty shithole, which is, I hope that's one they closed down in Washington, D.C., right outside of Chinatown. That was the worst fucking place I've ever been to. But, you know, love me some Hooters. And it's not about the restaurant. I've said this before that, when Sin and I first got together, we'd go and they'd come to the table, you know, they're friendly and shit. They want their tips and they'd be leaning in and their stuff. And Cindy said I would lean away. And I didn't even realize I was doing it. I was doing it subconsciously, leaning away from, you know, the girl, scantily clad girl or whatever. But cold beer, good food. But you know what? You're right. It's like McDonald's and shit. I'm coming to the point where I'm not paying you $14 for a hamburger and French fries from McDonald's, you know, and right. Hooters has got to raise their prices because everything's gone through the fucking roof. That's a shame. And it's been in the last 4 years. Take that for what you will, political wise. Yeah.
So when the kids were younger, my wife was going to a reunion. I forget whether it was a high school or college reunion. She was going to be out of town for a couple of days. So I'm home alone with the boys and, you know, she gives me the usual instructions. don't do anything stupid with them, blah, blah, right. blah, blah, blah. So
right.
I take them to Hooters mm-hmm. and I take my youngest, and I'm putting a picture up. Hopefully Woody can see this picture.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
Okay. So you see that one right there? So
that's funny.
I decide I'm going to F with my wife. So I give my son a Corona and teach him how to make a very drunk looking face.
Yeah. And he nailed it. He's only like 6 years old, y'all, in the picture. Yeah.
He's like 6 years old in the picture. And I text Miss Jerry and I say, hey, no worries here. I got everything under control.
I bet she lost her shit. Yeah. I bet that went over well. Right. So anyway.
That was an adventure in Hooters. But, you know, I was thinking that maybe the WOW should set up a nonprofit channel on OnlyFans, Woody, because you got a lot of displaced Hooters workers who could get in contact with their fans because they're no longer available in those restaurants that shut down. And, you know, we could have our own Hooters OnlyFans channel.
Yeah, well, my thought on that is I still can't log into OnlyFans. So if I can't log into it, we can't set up a nonprofit. I can't. Well, my phone won't let me log into it. I tried to log into OnlyFans. Yeah, I want to see what all that. We do more stories about OnlyFans than probably anything else except for Pinellas County. I can't log in.
This will become your account. Hooters account.
It can't become my account if I can't set it up. I'm trying to set up an account. That's why I'm telling the fans out there, send me your login. But then I guess I have a charge.
No one wants to admit they have one. Yeah. All right. We'll work on that. We'll work on that off air.
Yeah. All right. Well,
find all your 4th of July needs at low prices, all in the Kroger app. Get USDA choice bone-in tender ribeye steaks for $7.99 a pound with a digital coupon. Limit 5. Then buy 2, get 3 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
From the kind of funny to a way more serious, y'all, I'll tell you about West Virginia couple. And one of my good friends, my female doctor friend, is in West Virginia today looking for a piece of property to buy. Her and her husband want to, you know, have a place there. But this couple was wealthy and from West Virginia, and they're accused of forcing their adopted children to work as slaves and live inside a locked barn. Now imagine that, right? And now the impact of this story is exacerbated by the fact that the couple is white and 3 of their adopted children are black. Now we're not being racist. I'm reporting the real deal. So Donald Ray Lance, who's 63, and Jean K. Whitefeather, who's 62, of Charleston, West Virginia, they pled not guilty on Tuesday to multiple new charges after their kids were found locked in a dilapidated shed after allegedly working on the couple's farmland, right? Now, back in the day, in South Louisiana and shit, people had kids just so they could work the fields. You went to third grade, and then after that, your ass was out there picking cotton or hoeing a row or whatever the fuck.
Didn't lock them up in a shed.
No. You got to feed them enough and to keep them alive to work them, right? But they didn't lock them up in sheds. Probably they didn't have a shed. But anyway, the judge that's presiding over the case said the couple targeted their 5 kids, age 16, 14, 11, 9, and 6, because of their race, and stated they were used basically as slaves. Now, the couple was originally charged back in October when the 16 and 14 year old were found locked in that shitty shed. It was only 20 by 14. It had no lights, food, or running water. But it had a camera planted in the top left corner of the room, which filmed their every move, right? So their parents could watch them. The children were found wearing dirty clothes with sores on their feet and reeking of body odor after a wellness check was conducted on the shed or out of house, basically, that they were staying in. And the check revealed that the shed had no way of being open from the inside. So definitely they're locked in, right? And the shed sat on the grounds of the couple's 5-acre, 3-bedroom, Sissonville, West Virginia property. That's crazy. But the couple also owned an 80-acre home in Tenasket, Washington, which they were forced to sell after their October arrest. I guess they got to pay for lawyers and shit. And these motherfuckers. White Feather stated that the barn where the girl, 16, and the boy, 14, were found was a teenage clubhouse, right? And they were
nice clubhouse.
Yeah. And they were not held against their will. The mother told deputies the children, who were all in school, actually liked that they were locked in. Okay. Well, I guess if you know that old story, like if you were raised in the darkness in a cave, you just didn't know any better, maybe, but I don't know. However, the teenage girl told deputies they had been locked in the building for approximately 12 hours and were last given food at 6 a.m. The building only had a small RV porta potty and no running water, and that's according to the police report. The children were also forced to sleep on the hard concrete floor. Well, at least they put concrete down and it wasn't dirt, I guess. But the criminal complaint stated if there was a medical emergency or fire, the children would be unable to exit the locked room safely to safety, right? 3 hours after finding the older children in the locked shed, deputies found a 9-year-old girl holed up in a loft inside the family's locked main house. I'm sure they told her to go hide there. Now, Lance came home with the 11-year-old boy while White Feather surrendered the 6-year-old girl to authorities. And we have their pictures. We'll try to get them up for y'all. Child Protective Services were called at the time and took the children into custody, right? Y'all, I've had that happen so many times on cases, and such a heartbreaking thing. Even though the kids are being abused, you're ripping them out. CPS takes them and they buy them clothes and they get them bathed and they buy them toothbrushes and even some toys and shit, and they place them somewhere where they're safe. Now, it still sucks for them, right? But it doesn't suck as bad as being locked in a fucking shed. But the new charges the couple are facing include human trafficking of a minor child, use of a minor child in forced labor, and child neglect, creating substantial risk of seriously bodily injury or death. And their bond has been set at $500,000 each, which is $300,000 more than their original bonds. Now, the latest indictment outlining the upgraded charge claims the couple is guilty of human rights violations, alleging that the couple forced the children into hard labor because of their race. Okay. Kanawha County Circuit Judge Mary Claire Akers said that this case is the first of its kind that she has ever seen in her career, and that the couple's original bond of $200,000 was insufficient compared to the severity of their crimes. Now, along with human trafficking and neglect, was serious risk of bodily injuries or death. And I don't find the bond to be sufficient, Judge Akers said. It alleges human trafficking, human rights violations, and the use of forced labor. Now, human rights violations specific to the fact that these children were targeted because of their race and they were used basically as slaves that's what the indictment states, y'all. The minors involved, like I told you, were 16, 14, 11, 9, and 6. And the indictment says that of the adopted children are black. Prosecutors previously raised concerns that the couple's joint $400,000 bond in February might have come from their alleged human trafficking activities. Now, Kanawha County Assistant Prosecuting Attorney Christopher Coverniak reported that the couple who previously claimed to have no assets or income, sold their 80-acre ranch in Washington for $725,000 on February 2nd. 3 days later, White Feather's brother, Marcus Hughes, posted the two $200,000 bonds to get the couple out of the jail cells they were being held in. Then on March 28, Covernyak noted that they had also sold their home in Sissonville, where they were arrested. They sold the home for $295,000. And prosecutors concluded that despite whether or not the money was obtained illegally, it was originally intended for human trafficking. It's crazy. Deputies say there are no prior records for the two adults, at least in West Virginia. Now, the Kanawha County Sheriff's deputies previously said that a complaint was made back in May of 2023 about the couple, and a second complaint was made in September. The nature of those complaints were similar to the charges that the couple faces now, and CPS was also called on the family, according to a neighbor named Stacy Miller. And Miller told the West Virginia Watch that she witnessed the kids out in the yard with their heads down and forced to stand in a straight line. And she described what she saw as forced manual labor. And the couple's initial bond money is now in the custody of the court, which Covernyak said should be transferred to the children in the form of a trust fund. Well, that's not going to happen because...
Oh, I was just going to say, right? That's the first thing I've heard that is anything good possibly coming out of this case. That can't happen.
No. But somebody's going to be in charge of the trust, which is going to be him, and he can use this money to help them with scone, right, if they get back out on bond. So Whitefeather's attorney, Mark Plant, said at a hearing in February, the main allegation is that these children were locked in a shed. The evidence is going to show that there was a key inside. Well, how fucking convenient is that, right? Missed that. This case on its face sounds atrocious. However, there are really three sides to every story. There's theirs and the truth somewhere in the middle. But their next court appearance is set for September 9th. Now, let me tell you this. The WOW has a ton of listeners already, and it's gaining more every day. But I'm sure there's someone in West Virginia that works in the jail, the Kanawha County Sheriff's County Prison, I guess you call it. Someone's going to know that these people, three of these youth were African-American and they were being used. I mean, we don't know about the adoption process or what. If you take in children like that, you get a check from the state, right, to house them, even temporary housing. And then... The race card on this, holy fuck, they're gonna have a hard time in prison, as they should. Fuck them.
Absolutely. I mean they're
bad story.
So they're paid to take in, is it six kids in total or is it five?
Well, we don't know how many of them are their biological children, if any, but we know the three African American.
They're all adopted.
All right. Well. We definitely know three African Americans aren't, because I'm looking at the picture of these two idiots and they're white. But either way, that's bad business. And even
what I'm going is they're getting paid for five. Then they're putting those five to work. They're making money off what they're doing. They've got $1 million worth of homes that they've been able to acquire and apparently had paid for up until now. I mean, I don't know what the book is, but the book needs to be thrown at these people.
Yeah. I don't think they're going to live. Let me tell you something. Even murderers hate child abusers, right? And I'd be very surprised if there's not a sexual element to this that's going to end up coming out. Of course, I have to do the Child Advocacy Center interviews with these children. They're going to do that regardless. If it was sex or not, they'll do that with the forensic interviewer to find out all the shitty things that were actually done to them. Right. But even a murderer hates motherfuckers like this, and they'll get prison justice. Hopefully.
God. And just what a horrible message that sends. And it reinforces stereotypes and things that are out there that, look, we, as you always say, there are good and bad in every profession, and there's, you know, there's good and bad in people of every color, religion, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, in 2024 to hear of something like that, just, you know, will perpetuate the story that there's a lot of that goes on, which I think we would agree there's not a lot of it, but that it does go on, and here's an example of it. Yeah. It's all horrible.
Yeah. Horrible. It's really sad. Yeah. And I'm sitting here thinking about it. The six kids or five kids, whatever it was, I'm pretty sure they were taking all comers, who whatever kid they could get placed in their custody from the state, whether it's white or black or whatever. But the fact, you're right, in the times we live in and everything else, and rightfully so, they should be outraged about all the kids, whatever their race is. But the white people forcing African American kids into slavery, they got a real horrible fucking issue. Yeah.
That's absolutely horrible.
You're right. And it's horrible for the white kids too. Yeah, but I don't believe we've heard the last of that one.
Well, I hope we haven't.
Well, no, we'll keep them updated, because that's going to be that's a newsworthy story, right?
Well, we're going to need a pick me up after that, Woody.
Oh, I see this one's coming. No pun intended. So tell me about it. They've been in New York City, I can just see what's about to happen. And this one's interesting.
Well, there's this 36-year-old Canadian woman in New York who says she's fighting for gender equality. Each day, she shows her Big Apples while walking around the Big Apple, if you get the pun. That's right. Her name is Isla Adams, and she is flashing her breasts on the New York City subway. She's bouncing them atop the Brooklyn Bridge. She's dropping them at midnight in the heart of Times Square. For Isla, nudity isn't just a naughty hobby. She says it's an act of advocacy. If men can walk around shirtless without fear of reprisal, so too should women. That's her argument. She calls herself a content creator. And who are we at the WOW to argue with her as we are looking at some of her, quote, content? She spent the past 6 days granting New Yorkers a gander at her goodies, both her boobs and her bottom, in the name of gender equality. So she says, it's normal to be nude. By flashing folks as I go about my day, I'm just having a bit of cheeky fun and challenging the status quo. Okay.
Right.
Now, what I didn't realize is that there was a law passed in New York back in 1992, making this legal. So I didn't know any woman who wanted to could just walk around New York City topless, but that is apparently the case. So she calls herself a broadcaster. She works for something called the Naked News in Toronto. So you might want to search Naked News Toronto.
She is from Canada, by the way. Yeah, she is from Canada.
She claims that her titillating displays are deeply rooted in justice. She says that for over 30 years, it's been legal for women to go topless in New York City, which means many have embraced as a show of gender equality, citing the 1992 New York State court decision. I think flashing is entertaining, but it's also a way of normalizing toplessness. For me, it's a way of life. The Fit Fox further feels that all people should proudly publicize their privates. Nudity has been such an important part of my life. I do not understand anyone who has negative feelings towards being naked. Most people don't even notice I'm doing anything. I think they probably do notice that you're doing
something. Exactly. They're not looking.
But I do get caught. But if I do get caught, I'll give a smile, a thumbs up, and a laugh, she joked. And then she ended with, the last thing she said is, tits can light up a person's day. And while we've never heard that phrase before, I think, Woody, we'd have to agree that tits can light up a person's day.
Definitely, unless you got your little kid with you or your wife with you and you're looking and she slaps the shit out of you. But you know what? I would like to go back and see when she started posting these photos. She's doing it for money. I would like to see what her Instagram and TikTok, all that bullshit was before she started it, or her OnlyFans before she started it and what she's got now. Right. I mean,
let's face it, folks. It has nothing to do with justice. And this
it has nothing to do with what does she say? Women's equality, whatever the fuck, gender equality.
But look, the brilliant part is I lived there in 1992. I have no memory of that, or it didn't become a thing after that. I have no memory of there being any sort of events that were like that. I mean, there are specific beaches in the summer around New York that are nude beaches, but there are not women walking around topless in New York City. So she saw that angle and she's got the stuff, so to speak, to carry what she's doing. And you're right. She's probably made a ton of money doing this.
And you know what? I have new respect for New York City now. 1992, they were definitely ahead of the game on that one. So New Orleans, you know, it's an unwritten rule, but you can get arrested at some point, but not in New York City. All right. Well,
New Orleans confined to really a certain area of New Orleans.
You're not walking in on St. Charles Avenue, whipping them out, you know, where the neighbors can get offended, if you will.
No, so, look, I think she has the potential. I mean, New York's in a bad way right now. She has the potential to turn around the economy in the city. I mean, if she inspired hundreds of other women to follow her lead, and all of a sudden walking the streets of New York all day long were just, you know,
naked people. Yeah.
Women walking the streets.
Then they would become a more of a tourist destination. They'd have to put up a lot of benches and people could just sit there and people watch. Yeah. Yeah. Or
unfortunately,
take pictures.
It would probably inspire violence and crime and turn into something horrible. But
you get robbed for sitting there. Yeah. Well,
Woody, you've got a great new marketing partner to tell the audience about, and I think this one is right up our alley.
I do, and I feel very strongly about this. So let me tell you, when I was in the Army, when I was in basic training, I was at Fort McCullen, Alabama, and every night for mail call, you had to toe the line in the dormitory and the drill sergeant coming down. And for every letter you got, you had to do 10 pushups, right? I got more letters than anybody did. So it got to the point where the drill sergeant would walk in the door and say, toe the line. And they'd say, Overton, beat your face and don't stop until I leave, right? Except, you know, a lot of people wrote me. But there's nothing better than getting a care package. Now, when you're in the military and you get a care package, all your buddies, you know, your best buds, you're going to share with them and everything else. It just fucking means a lot. So I want to talk to y'all about a new sponsor of all of the RMRC Network shows. And the name of the company is Hero Care Packages. And they do exactly what it sounds like. They create care packages that family and friends can send to their loved ones in the military. Now, I know many of you lifers have sons, daughters, grandchildren, nieces, and nephews, and friends currently serving. And that's awesome, right? And this is a great way to let them know how much you care. Now, Hero Care Packages was founded by a military veteran, Jack Ray, who said, when we pulled into a port in the Navy, sailors who had been at sea for months would wait for hours in line just to see if they had received any mail. And as an officer, I was always heartbroken when I saw sailors who didn't receive any packages. And yeah, that's the real deal. The guys in my dorms and my unit that didn't get packages, I'd let them read my letters and shit. Yeah, it's sad that they don't have that family support. So back to it, Jack created Hero Care Packages to fix all that.
And Hero Care Packages created this fully customized model where you can either choose specific items and combine them into a really personalized package, or you can choose from a large selection of pre-curated packages. So the team at Hero Care Packages handles everything else. All you do is log on, and that's herocarepackages.com, and either select a package from their menu or customize one yourself. You can even purchase a gift card if you want to let your hero shop for themselves and build their own. So all you've got to do is go to herocarepackages.com and make your selection. Use the promo code RLRC at checkout, and you'll get 10% off on your entire purchase. And you can join us in spreading positivity and gratitude to our heroes. Shop now. Let them know that they are appreciated. That is herocarepackages.com and the promo code RLRC for 10% off. Can't think of a better cause, Woody, a great fit for us and our audience.
In this world that we live in today, everybody wants thing to be easier. And, you know, I could certainly see the y'all go at least check out the site. It's amazing. I mean, whoever you got, they got something for them. But I'm telling you, I've received care packages. It's awesome. And this will save you time and save you money and get it shipped out and done professionally, right? So I think it's awesome. And that's go to herocarepackages.com and it's code RLRC.
Beautiful. Well, I don't know exactly how this is going to go over, folks, because Woody and I have worked sort of separately on this over the past few days. But if you were listening to last Monday's episode, you know that Woody and I agreed to conduct an experiment, an examination of the evidence of the Jerry Sandusky Penn State scandal. And I've said for really since day one of getting involved with Woody and Jim that I knew this case well and believed that Jerry Sandusky was innocent. And the wow being the wow, we're able to do some things differently than we do them on the other shows. And so this is a great opportunity for me to get the benefit of Woody's expertise and have him challenge the assumptions in our investigation. Well, have him do whatever he's going to do because I'm exposing him to all of the investigative research and evidence that John Ziegler turned up during the 10 years of looking into this case and everything I did in the 3 years of coming together with John to produce the series with the benefit of hindsight that we produced. And so we're going to call this segment Nittany Lying. It comes from, you know, Penn State's nickname is the Nittany Lions, and that's because State College sits in this valley, which they call Happy Valley. And that mountain that is right behind it is Nittany Mountain. And so that's where Nittany Lion comes from.
So, Michael, let me interrupt you real quick. I got some social media posts that I read this morning, and I hadn't got to tell you about it yet, where lifers are asking where can they listen to the benefit of hindsight these episodes. So we need to put a link in or something. Of course you can tell people, but it's easier if you go on the crew page or whatever and just put the link to that podcast. And there were several of them. People have taken interest in what we're going to be doing here and, you know, make it easy for them.
That's awesome.
You can say it, but it's much easier. You say it, but please go in into our platforms and put it, and we'll get it put in an app and everything else, because this is not a small story. This is why we're going to start a segment ending Monday shows, because it's a lot. And before we continue, I just want to say this. I have an open mind about it, but I'm digesting it piece by piece. And I'm going to say what I'm going to say, that no disrespect to Ziegler or what's the lady's name that was on the episode of the sportscaster?
Liz Habib.
No disrespect to any of them, but I'm just going to call piece by piece. I'm going to call it how I see it.
That's great. And I want you to do that. And I think it's great that what we'll do is, in the show notes and on our social, we'll post a link to the episode that we are going to be talking about in that week's episode. So it's really easy for people to just go hit. They know that's what we're going to be talking about. And so this week we're going to be talking about episode one of With the Benefit of Hindsight, which is called The Date. And I want to just give you a little bit of background before we get into that. So I was like all of you and like Woody back in 2011 when this story became the story. And it not only became the story of 2011, this was the number one news story in the country through 2011 and 2012. And so when Woody says this is no small story, no, it's a humongous story, especially in the northeastern part of the country. And a story that got more media attention than any other story out there. And so, like everybody else, I was watching and listening to the media. And, you know, the media were all perfectly clear. The former defensive coordinator at Penn State, who had started a charity for underprivileged kids back in 1979, had used that nonprofit, which is known as the Second Mile, to target, groom, and abuse young boys. That was the story. The Attorney General of Pennsylvania at that time in 2011 was a woman named Linda Kelly. She called a press conference. I think this was on November 5th, and she read from what is known as a grand jury presentment. And this is exactly what she read. She said, quote, "He saw a naked boy whose age he estimated to be 10 years old with his hands up against a wall being subjected to anal intercourse by a naked Sandusky. The next morning, a Saturday, the graduate assistant," that's the person who's witnessing this, "telephoned Paterno," that's Joe Paterno, Penn State's legendary football coach, "and went to Paterno's home where he reported what he had seen." And so the way the public was brought into this case was through this press conference and the reading of this language out of the presentment, telling the public that there was a witness, a former graduate assistant from Penn State, who saw Jerry Sandusky sodomize a boy in a Penn State shower back in 2002. So that announcement had a huge impact on everyone, and huge impact on public opinion. The attorney general wouldn't lie about what a witness had seen, right? She went on to say that the Commonwealth had a lead victim who had come forward and that they were seeking to locate other victims of Sandusky following the serving of the indictment. And so from 2011, when this comes out, all the way through the trial and everything else up until 2019, I accepted 100% the conventional wisdom of this story. In 2019, I became aware of a counter narrative because of a relationship I have with the investigative journalist John Ziegler. I didn't know that Ziegler was involved in this case in any way, but John reached out to me. We went to lunch, and he explained that he had been basically consumed by this case for, at that point, a total of 8 years, and that he had lots of evidence, and he made that evidence available to me. He had visual evidence. He had all kinds of evidence put together over an 8 year period. And by the time I reviewed all of that stuff, I was sure that he was right about what he thought about this case. And I made the decision to back him. I made the decision to fund initially a podcast with the commitment to film a documentary following the podcast and do everything that I could do in my power to help him tell this side of the story and get it out. It has been an incredibly difficult and disappointing endeavor. Forget the money for a second. This has been a narrative that is very broadly known and is very deeply locked in the minds of most Americans, and most people are close their minds to hearing any different take on the case. And so, what we're doing, I'm really excited about, which is exposing Woody to the case as we saw it, episode by episode, and then us getting back together here each Monday on the WOW for a Nittany Lying segment where Woody and I will discuss what we put in that particular episode, and he'll ask me the questions that he has from it, and we'll just see where it goes. And so Nittany Lying segment one, episode one, the date. So Woody, where do you want to start?
All right. So many different points on this. And first of all, the grand jury, basically, it's a true bill of indictments, what we would call in Louisiana, where, and I'm reading it, says he saw a naked boy whose age he estimated to be 10 years old with his hands against the wall being subjected to anal intercourse, which is sodomy, rape, because it's a 10-year-old, right, by a naked Sandusky. The next morning, a Saturday, the graduate assistant telephoned Joe Paterno and went to Paterno's home where he reported what he had seen. Now, the I will start off by saying that part, and you can back me up on this, that it changed to where it wasn't, he didn't say he saw anal penetration. He said that he walked in and saw Sandusky and a juvenile who was later on identified, and we'll get into that about the dates, et cetera. That's what he'd seen, correct?
Well, he changed his story about five times. So it depends on where, but at trial, he said he entered the locker room. He heard slapping sounds, that he walked toward the slapping sounds. He heard the showers on and slapping sounds, that he walked towards them, that he got an angle that allowed him to look through a mirror, that through that mirror, you could peer into the showers where he saw Sandusky near a boy who actually turned out to be 14, not 10, but that's all that he saw. He didn't see any kind of sexual contact.
So first thing we agree upon is this statement that was initially given to the grand jury is bullshit, right? He changed it to ultimately what he testified at trial. All right. Which is he didn't see the sexual contact, but he alleges he saw him and it was suspicious. Okay.
But what's really important is that he changed his story a bunch, but he never said what they said he said in the presentment. He never told anyone. No version of his story includes him seeing sodomy.
Right. And I get that. And good and bad in every profession. This is the hot potato. Joe Paterno's God at Penn State and everything else. And whatever reason, the attorney general comes out and says a statement. Obviously, the statement isn't true. Okay. To the part that he saw Sandusky sodomizing the kid. Now, it doesn't matter if the kid's 14 or 10, he's still a fucking kid. So let's go back to this episode, because so we're taking an episode by episode. This name of this episode was the date. And the gist of it, and I want you to tell me why this is important, and then I'm going to ask you a question. The gist of this whole fucking thing was that, first of all, he said it was in March, and when the campus was empty, it was the first day of spring break or whatever the fuck. They proved the date. He said that Ziegler didn't prove the date that he said that, you know, happened, couldn't have happened, because there was, and I may get some dates wrong and some names wrong, whatever, but you'll get to just what I'm saying. There was a fucking hockey game going on. There was a concert. There was this, there was that. So they come back and they spend all this time disproving the March date, right? Then they say it's a February date. And I'm paraphrasing for y'all who haven't listened. Then they say it's a February date
of the prior year. So they said March of 2002, and then they came back February of 2001.
Right. So they say it's a February date. And then they spend all this time on why it's not a February date. Right. And ultimately they go back to say it must have been sometime in December, everything from fucking Rudy was on to whatever. It doesn't matter. But the whole episode is about this date. Now, let me ask you a question. Okay. Do you remember reaching out to me for the first time about us possibly working together? Almost 2 years ago, or probably close to 2 years,
right? About 2 years.
And that's an important fucking conversation, and everything's grown out of it, right? To where we are now. Here we are discussing this. Okay, I want you to tell me what that date was.
I don't know.
Okay, but it's an important event. You agree with that, right? It's an important event. I agree it's an important event. I'm laying in bed thinking about this last night. I can't tell you the fucking date. Right.
Well, if you can't on tell that me date that. You had seen me, if on that date you had seen me sodomizing a boy, remember that date.
I have conceded that he didn't see him sodomizing a boy. But what he saw, he's saying he saw, and he testified to in open court, even though he changed his story a bunch of times, is that on, you know, whatever the date may be, he saw Sandusky naked in the shower with a kid. right?
The,
okay. So, but my point on the date is it, and there's a lot more, and we'll get into it in just a second. My point on the date is just because you don't remember now, this is like 2011 and this happened in either 2002 or 2003. So you and I been together almost 2 years and we can't remember the exact date of a fucking super important conversation we had that led us to where we are now. How do you expect this cat to remember what the date is? I'm not saying that he didn't change the story. I'm not saying he didn't change the story. I'm just saying that when you're pressed upon something like that, you're like, you know what? You proved it wasn't March. You proved it wasn't February. It was December. I saw him naked in the shower with a kid.
I understand. So the significance of the date, and Ziegler early on in the episode is very quick to say, hey, look, in a situation like that, anybody's liable to not remember the exact date that something happened. The significance of it is that this story exploded not because a former defensive coordinator who was retired for 10 years, who was only really known regionally, was allegedly abusing boys. This story exploded because the legendary coach of Penn State, the president of Penn State, the athletic director at Penn State, and the vice president of administration at Penn State were all accused of covering up committed allegedly by Sandusky over a broad period of time. And the significance of this date ties to the possibility, any possibility of there having been a cover up. And the date evidence is used by Ziegler in the episode to prove that there's no possibility of there having been any cover up.
Okay. All right. So we'll agree that the date really doesn't make a fuck if it's all something at all. Now let's go to the next point, what you just said, because I thought a lot about this. Now there's supposedly this graduate assistant who wanted the wide receivers coaching job and all this shit. The one that he says he saw Sandusky in the shower with the naked kid, right? Supposedly, he calls Paterno's house and Paterno says, he says, I need to come talk to you, right? Well, Paterno's guy. And I'm like, you got to stay with me because I got to put all this in context for you because I've experienced some of this to a certain level. So he calls Paterno, and Paterno says, if this is about a job, I don't have one for you. Well, kid says, okay, I'm coming over anyway. So allegedly, he tells Paterno what he saw. And Paterno says, okay, I'll look into it or something to that effect. Now that absolutely. I know the guy changed the story, but you have to keep an open mind on it. Absolutely. That's what I would have done. I'm going to the head motherfucker, right? Because Paterno is going to know who to turn it over to. And he's going to be, whatever he's going to do. Now, here's the thing. Paterno may have been thinking this cat's lying or trying to get a leg up to get this position, which he does end up getting years later, the wide receiver coaching position. But you go to Paterno, if I'm Paterno, what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna call the head motherfucker that I'm gonna say, hey, look, this graduate assistant just came in and said he saw Jerry naked in the shower, and it may have been something inappropriate, may not. You need to look into this shit. You know why? Jim Paterno is not a fucking investigator, right? But he's got shit on his mind and he's going to pass it off. It's not the first time he's ever got a complaint about some coach doing something wrong or whatever it may be. He ain't investigating these himself. He's going to pass it off to the powers that be and let them investigate it. And whatever recommendation, if they come back and say, well, yeah, this coach was stealing or whatever, we've proved that well, fuck him. He's fired, right? And so I believe it's all speculation, but I think that it's a totally acceptable venue for this kid to go in, this graduate assistant coach, to go and say, hey, coach, this isn't about, the coaching job. This is what I saw. Joe Paterno says, okay, we'll look into it. Joe Paterno calls whatever his name is, who actually turns out that one of the ones, those four you mentioned, I can't remember his name, is actually the police chief or something relation to the campus police department, which is not a rent-a-cop deal. It's like when I was a campus police at Southeastern, we were certified police officers, right? And he was like high up on that. And he's high up in the university. And if Joe calls him and they're friends, he's like, hey, you know, such and such just came and told me he saw Sandusky naked in the kid with a teenager in the shower, right? Yeah. Okay. Joe's off the hook. If I'm Joe, I'm off the hook. I told whomever, right? And because I'm not an investigator, I'm not going to go investigate this. I'm not going to call Sandusky in and say, were you fucking a kid in the shower? Let somebody else do that. That's their job. But I'm calling the guy that I think is best suited to handle it, and he's going to call whoever the fuck he thinks is best suited to handle it, and they're going to look into it. Now, the next thing on this episode was the update.
Can I just stop
you? Yeah.
Can I just stop you for 1 second on that?
Yeah.
Okay. So
I get rolling so I don't lose my train of thought, but go ahead.
But here's the sequence of events. And this is, I'm going to give you the things that are not in dispute that everyone agrees happened. According to McQuarrie, when he sees what he sees, his immediate instinct is to call his father.
Right.
His father tells him to come over to his house. He drives from the Lash building, which is the athletic center at Penn State, to his father's house, where his father's boss, who is a doctor by the name of Jonathan Dranov, joins with John McQuarrie, who is Mike McQuarrie, who's the graduate assistant's father. So McQuarrie sees what he sees in the locker room, and his first instinct is not to call the police, not to go into a shower and stop anything, or
because he wasn't sure what he saw. Yeah. Okay.
His first instinct is to go to his dad's house. While he's at his dad's house, he is asked 3 times by Dranov, and Dranov testifies, as does John McQuarrie, to this. He's asked 3 times whether he saw anything sexual, and he says, no, I did not.
That,
3 times.
And let me interrupt you for a second. So you run to your dad's first, and the doctor's there. That's understandable, right? If same thing like them, he told, I didn't see anything. I didn't see the penetration. I didn't see whatever. But hey, motherfucker, I called you, and I'm over here telling you because I think it gave me a little bit of the heebie-jeebies, right? That I'm certainly not going to go to the cops and accuse Jerry Sandusky of fucking a kid in the shower if I didn't see that. But there was nobody else in the shower, and you know, it made me feel uncomfortable. I did whatever, and I better have gone and told my dad. My dad probably would have told me to go do what he did. But go ahead.
Okay, that's fine. So he describes what he can describe, and he is told by them, and Dranov, as a doctor, is a mandatory reporter, and so if it was indicated to him that there was anything sexual involved, he is obligated to go to the police. So he
does not tell. And I'm going to interrupt you a lot. Exactly. You're making my point. He goes to his dad and says, you know, this is weird. The doctor's there. The doctor is a mandatory reporter, but you already said he told him 3 times he didn't see anything sexual. Didn't mean he didn't feel like there was something sexual or something wrong. Otherwise, he wouldn't have gone to him. You see what I'm saying? And so, the doctor doesn't have to report that. But I mean, he told me 3 separate times I didn't see anything sexual. But you know what? I still feel strongly enough about it that I'm here talking to y'all. You know? And so the doctor's off the hook on the mandatory reporting.
We're in complete agreement. What
right.
exact words he used, don't know. At minimum, I saw something. It creeped me out. It was weird. Right. Why is Sandusky in a shower with this kid, right? So the advice they give him is go see Joe Paterno and tell him what you saw.
Absolutely.
Now, this is where the dates come in, because the attorney general has first told the public the lie about sodomy, but then said that he went the next morning to see Joe Paterno and told him what he saw, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So they tell us in the same presentment that he witnessed this event on March 1st of 2002, right? And that he knows that's the date, recalls that as the date, because campus was desolate, because it was the first Friday of spring break. And they use that as a rationale for Sandusky expecting the locker room to be empty, right, and that he'd have the ability to abuse this kid without being caught. Yeah.
I understand. And also, everyone remember, this is when he's under the gun 9 years later, okay, that he's given this first date. But go ahead.
Correct. So it becomes understood sometime between Sandusky's arrest and well before his trial, that as more evidence comes in, evidence that is provided by Gary Schultz, who is that VP of administration at Penn State, shows through emails that McQueary goes to see Joe Paterno on February 10th of 2001. So the actual date that we know he sees Paterno to tell him about this event is February 10th of 2001. So that is a locked date that that they are now using. So in the middle of a case, they say, sorry, folks, we had the date wrong. Here's the date. This is when he went to see Joe Paterno, right?
Because they investigated and were able to prove, even if they never announced it, it couldn't have been that other date because all this other shit was going on. So they did the right thing. But they may not got the February date right, but they did the right thing in moving the date from March. I'm sure they had long discussions on what date it could have been with that. Again, it's 9 years later. You and I can't tell the date the first time we talked a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, whenever
it was. Not faulting them for that. I mean, it's a strange thing to have happen in the middle of a case, but you know, you're right. It's an unusual, unique case, 10 years apart. But the key thing is, this is a fact that is not disputed by anyone. And I want to make sure I'm clear on what the fact is. The thing that's a fact is that is the date he went to tell Paterno about what he saw, right? So the assumption is that since he told everybody that he went the next day to see Paterno, that he therefore must have witnessed this event, whatever happened in the shower between Sandusky and a kid, on February 9th, 2001, because the only way he could have seen Paterno and told him what he saw the very next day is if he saw what he saw on February 9th of 2001, because we know he told Paterno on February 10th of 2001. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but I'll reserve my comments for the end. Go ahead.
Okay, so if we know that February 9th is the date that he witnessed this event, we should be able to confirm some of the other things that he has said about the night he witnessed the event, which, going back, is that the campus was empty because it was spring break, that no one else was in the locker room area, that he heard these slapping sounds and that's what led him to believe that there were other people there. He actually thought it was a couple having, traditional sex in the locker. But when you examine February 9th of 2001 at Penn State, there was a sold out Bare Naked Ladies concert at the concert venue at Penn State that seats 18,000 people immediately across from the building that the showers are in, the Lash building. There was a home hockey game that approximately 1,000 people attended that night of February 9th that actually is attached to the Lash football lockers. So the 1,000 people attending the hockey game would have been competing directly for parking spots, would have been using the hockey teams, would have been using the locker facility.
And I touched on that a few minutes ago, and I do not disagree with the fact of that. What I am going to tell you is, and what you're going to say is that date couldn't happen either. I get that. Okay. And we're coming back 9 years later, however long it is later. And we know that Attorney General lied in the indictment. That's bullshit. They try to change the date from March because they proved that couldn't happen. Now we got another date, right? We're thinking this might fit, and they didn't do their homework like Ziegler and them did or Sandusky side did. And so we're able to prove now absolutely that he didn't go tell him on February or the day after on February 10th, right? Because God and everybody was in there and he couldn't have witnessed it at that time. I agree with that. But my point is the date fucking doesn't matter. You're coming back 9 years later, whatever the date is, he saw it. He went and told his daddy and the doctor and whomever. He may have thought about it for a while before he went to Paterno, but at some point, even Paterno's wife, who says the part about whatever didn't happen, she even admits the kid comes up, the graduate assistant comes over and has the brief meeting with Paterno when he's getting out of the shower and everything else. My whole point of this first episode is the date doesn't fucking matter. He went at some point, this dude went in to the locker room. I believe he got it right about campus being empty and shit like that, because that would fit in if that was taking place and Sandusky would feel comfortable about it. I totally agree that the campus was empty and all this shit. When he goes over for whatever reason and he sees something makes him feel uncomfortable and he went and told his daddy and them, when he told Paterno, whether it was a day later or 10 days later or whatever, he went over there at some point and told him. And Joe Paterno did what I would have done if I was Joe Paterno, passed it off to call, hey, you know what? We might have a problem here. I don't think there's a problem, but just your wheelhouse, you fucking go deal with it, right? And that person went and did whatever they do and all that. My point is, it doesn't matter if it happened in December. And he's got it either he fucking lied about how long it is till he went to Paterno. Maybe he caught some pressure that in between. Maybe he saw something else. I don't know. I wasn't there. But the date doesn't matter. What matters is the fact that he felt strongly enough to call his daddy and go over there and report it to him and that doctor. Hey, no, you know what? I didn't see him fucking, but damn sure, you know, I'm here because I feel like something was inappropriate. Go tell Coach Joe, right? Well, so what does the date matter? Okay, so, the date doesn't matter.
So Woody, I couldn't disagree with you more. The date is critical. And the date is critical because Ziegler is able to triangulate to a date that you heard him in the episode that Malcolm Gladwell in his investigation agreed to and adopted as the date from his perspective. All the administrators agreed to the date. Here's why it matters. If McQueary had seen something of significance, there would have been some urgency on his part to make sure Paterno knew about it. And
calling his dad and going and telling the dad and the doctors not a sense of urgency. And after they asked him three separate times, did you see anything sexual? And he says, no, that might have took the urgency off of for me.
We don't actually know when that meeting with his father and Dranov took place. He says he went immediately over there from the locker room, but we don't have any evidence. We don't have any evidence.
Could have been whenever.
Take place immediately. But so
but we know we, that, but we know the do, meeting took. We know the meeting took place at some point.
We know it took place at some point.
And date is irrelevant. And
we know that the conversation with Paterno takes place on February 10th, 2001. The
supposedly they could have got that wrong too.
No, they couldn't have. They couldn't have got that wrong because we have the emails from Paterno to the administrators saying that that he had just gotten the visit from Mike McQueary, who saw something in the locker room with Sandusky and a boy, and so.
That date is locked. So what's not locked is whether it was the next day that he went and told him, you know, because all the shit that was going on or whatever. So we have to agree that date is locked. I'll give you that. Joe Paterno did exactly what Woody Overton would have done. He sent an email, but probably didn't even make a phone call because he didn't think it's important enough. What we will evidently always be in dispute on is this motherfucker saw something in the shower. Now let's go back to it. Jerry Sandusky admits. He said, well, it couldn't have been this date. Cause you know what? That kid was with me. I went to a fundraiser or whatever it was. And he's driving across the state with this fucking kid, the same one that was in the shower. And he was like, it wasn't that night, but yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but yeah, we've taken showers together before, right?
Yes.
Okay. So the whenever the date was that the graduate assistant coach saw it, it is what it is. And even Sandusky says, hey, it couldn't have been this date because I was with this kid driving across the state or whatever. But yeah, I've taken showers with him before. So it's not outside of the realm of possibility. At some point, this graduate assistant came in there and got a bad feeling to the point where he went and told his daddy and the doctor that I saw them butt naked in the shower together. Right. So the date, the email goes out. Great. What date he actually saw it, who knows? Right. I mean, the guy lied several times. He changed shit. But the one thing he never changed was the fact that he saw Sandusky naked in the shower with a kid. And it gave him bad enough feeling that he called his daddy. I'm not saying anything. I'm not saying Sandusky was fucking him. The date part, what date he saw it and what day he told Paterno, it don't make a fuck. He still saw what he saw.
It does.
No.
Here's why it does. Woody, I heard you. And I don't disagree with most of what you just said, but here's why it matters. So we are able, and when listeners listen to the episode, I think they will agree that we are successful in identifying the actual date that he witnessed what he witnessed. And that date was December 29th of 2000. Okay. December 29th of 2000. Penn State didn't make a bowl game that year. It's the first time in forever. The football season was over at the end of November. It was winter break. School was closed. Campus desolate. There are other things in the description McQueary gives of the night that also fit with December 29th of 2000, which we know from the boy, whose name is Alan Myers, who actually becomes identified and gives his own statement and claims to be, quote, the boy in the shower, that this happened on December 29th, 2000. He also, by the way, says in his statement Sandusky never touched me. We were slapping towels at each other. We've often done that after workouts over the years. And his relationship with Sandusky was very much a father-son relationship. But what we know is the incident happens on December 29th. At some point, he talks to his father and Dranov. Maybe it was right after, maybe it wasn't. They tell him not go to the cops. They tell him to go to Paterno. We know he goes to Paterno on February 10th of 2001, approximately 40 some days.
Right. For whatever reason.
40-something days after he's seen this thing. And my point with that is that it cannot be urgent in his mind if he waits 45 days. If the attorney general came out and made it very clear, and this was important to them because you have a 6'4", 230-pound former quarterback at Penn State who could have just taken Jerry Sandusky by his lapel and carried him out of the locker room to the police. He didn't do any of that. He didn't make his presence known to Sandusky or the kid.
He also said he didn't see anything sexual. Had he seen him with his penis in his ass, I'm sure he'd have gone over there and snatched him or hollered at him or something.
Okay. So he waits 45 days to go to Paterno and tell Paterno what he told him. And then Paterno immediately shares what he told him to both,
as he should,
the athletic director, Tim Curley, and the VP, Schultz, tells them both that Mike came to see me, said he saw something weird with Jerry in the Lash building, and I think you two need to sit down with him, right? So at minimum, I think you agree with me that Paterno didn't do anything wrong here. He did what?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And then we'll get to those episodes. I think he got fucked an overall part of it. But the deal being is we can end it with this. We can agree that whether it was on December the whatever and however long it took him to go, 40 some days, whatever. We'll never know why. I mean, everybody is different. And if he went to his daddy and them and the doctor and they're thinking, well, no, you didn't see anything. And it's Jerry Sandusky. And even though, you know, actually, so for the listeners who don't know, Sandusky wasn't even the coaching there anymore, but he had access to the facilities because he was a fucking legend, right? And so you're going to accuse a legend of something that you have a bad gut feeling about, but you didn't see anything. Well, maybe the kid, maybe this graduate assistant took 45 days to think about it. Who knows? I wasn't there. You weren't there. But it's a known fact that it's not disputed, even by Sandusky himself. I don't think Sandusky saw the guy see him in the shower. But it's a fact that this guy went to his daddy and his doctor at some point and said, you know what? That could have happened. That could have happened 2 weeks after what he saw. We don't know, which would cut your 45-day timeline down to a 20-day timeline. And he's thinking, well, they're saying I'm not seeing.
He saw what he saw.
Right. No, what I'm saying is he could have told his whatever. The date doesn't matter. What's not disputed is that he saw him, and Jerry Sandusky said, we take showers together. And the kid said, yeah, we pop towels, whatever. I'm not saying he saw him raping him. I'm saying he saw what he saw on some date, went to his father and his doctor on some date, and was told to go tell Joe. And on some date, over February, whatever, he actually went to Joe. Joe did what he was supposed to do.
Okay.
There's no dispute in any of that.
Here's context that is really important to all of this. So in later episodes, we'll learn about victim one, a kid by the name of Aaron Fisher. And the grand jury spent 2 years working with Aaron
love
Fisher.
Love you. Don't get ahead. Stay on the date. Today's episode is the date.
I'm staying on the episode. This is a crucial part of the episode.
Of the date.
It's all in episode one. This is all crucial right. information in episode one, which is called the date. The grand jury was not based upon that victim going to indict Sandusky. They were ready to drop the case. There are emails communicating that they were ready to drop the case. The case was leaked. That's later on, but anyway, it gets into the public that there's an investigation of Jerry Sandusky going on. McCreary doesn't come forward during that time period that it's public that there's an investigation of Jerry Sandusky and potential child abuse going on. McCreary is approached by the police after someone on a Penn State message board talking about the investigation into Sandusky says, somebody should go talk to Mike McCreary. There were rumors that he saw something with Sandusky in a locker room back around 2000. So police go to see.
Yeah. Hey, you must have listened to a different episode than I did. Cause I listened to 2 hours of it and nothing you're saying was on that episode.
Oh, it absolutely is. Did you hear the phone call with Van Natta from ESPN?
Yeah, and now they're saying he got caught blocked from ever reporting the story. Yeah.
So McCreary, when the police approach him, doesn't think it has anything to do with Sandusky. He goes and gets a lawyer. He negotiates a deal for 10 days. He won't talk to the police until he's fully lawyered up. When he does talk to them, he believes it's going to be about him shaving points in football games
right.
and him sending dick pics to college co-eds.
Right.
When the police tell him, we're here about Jerry Sandusky, we heard that you saw something in the Penn State showers, that's the greatest news in the world to McCreary. He thinks he's in a shitload of trouble, and instead it's them coming to him looking for help with the case. But they know the other shit.
Right.
And so again, it's out there. If I'm a query and I thought I saw something I think what McCreary thought was, that's fucking weird. It's 2001. It's 2002. It's 2000. A 60-year-old man shouldn't be showering with a whatever age he thought the boy was. He thought it was really weird. And he told his dad and the doctor about it. And he never really thought about it again until they tell him he needs to talk to Paterno. He's actually not planning on talking to Paterno. And then on February 8th, Penn State loses their wide receiver coach, Kenny Jackson, who goes to work for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And all of a sudden, Penn State has an opening for a wide receiver coach. So when he says, Joe Paterno on the phone said, if this is about a job, I don't have one for you. That's just, in my opinion, that's him trying to change what actually happened in the meeting. And that's why Sue Paterno said that never happened. He simply came over, asked Joe Paterno about that opening. Paterno said, you're not ready yet. We're going to go with someone else. And then McCreary said,
okay,
by the way,
right,
I saw this involving, you should know about it, involving Sandusky.
Real quick.
That's when Paterno tells the administrators.
Very, very, very good. Okay. And I probably agree McCreary's a dickhead. And he went over, maybe try to float his shit for the wide receivers coach, and Paterno tells him no, and then he throws that up. Okay, so there was no urgency or whatever, like you said, is 45 days later. And he throws this up as a little saving grace to Joe, saying, hey, you know, basically, I got your back. You might want to watch out for this. I don't think anything happened. But the one thing that's never come out, and why I think the date still to this day is irrelevant, as is that it wasn't a fucking, he never reported it as a crime. He never said, I saw him raping the kid in the shower. Now, later on, that when it gets started out, evident Sandusky is given, and we'll get into that. Sandusky is getting investigated all these years later, to the point where someone tells the cops, you need to go talk to McQuarrie. So it's McQuarrie's seeing him in the shower, whether they were horse playing or whatever, whatever the fuck, it doesn't matter. I mean, they only find McQuarrie years later because someone's, you know, tells the cops, you need to go talk to this dude. He saw something in the shower. He never said he saw him raping him. Go ahead.
Woody, the attorney general, told the entire country that he saw him anally raping a boy in a shower, and went the next day to Joe Paterno and told him what he saw. And so that, it matters in a huge way, because public opinion in this case drove this case. And in the course of 4 days following the attorney general coming out and lying to the public about the evidence, the public formed its opinion of this case. And the timing of all of this does matter, because if you could go back to that date and the attorney general were to come out and say, we are indicting Jerry Sandusky, there's a graduate assistant who saw him in the shower with a young boy back on this date, and he told Joe Paterno about it 6 weeks later, it would have been Jerry Sandusky never would have had his rights violated if the truth had been told and the timing were understood, and the date is an important part of that.
I started this out by saying, obviously, the attorney general is fucking lying, right? And whether she got him in there and she squeezed more out of him about the date being wrong or whatever, but the and yeah, him seeing the penis in the buttocks and whatever going on, that's a fucking lie. I started out saying it. We agreed upon that, right? And then we went back to talking about what he actually saw or didn't see, and what he did or didn't do. And the date is what it is. At some point, he went to Paterno for whatever reason and reported it. It's after talking to his daddy and the doctor, he went and reported it, and nothing came out of it till all these years later, right? The attorney general's line, we get that. We started with that. We're going back and talking about this episode about the date change and the date change and what is ultimately, it's, I mean, I think you agree with me. Ultimately, at some point, he went in the locker room and he saw Sandusky in the shower with a kid, and the kid said they took showers together. But he never said he saw anything sexual. I already concurred with you that the attorney general was fucking lying. We were talking about what he saw or didn't see, and the date he saw it. If he saw it in December the 21st or December the 5th, and didn't report to whatever. That what I'm saying. He's at some point.
Okay,
he says he saw something.
Okay,
but it wasn't sexual.
Need to wrap. But let's say this, that we disagree on the significance of the date at this point, but I think
not from the standpoint that the attorney general came out and said was on this. I'm talking about the shit that McQuarrie said and how they disproved it on the campus. He saw something at some point, period. And he reported.
Okay. I only have one question for you. Mm-hmm. Based upon what you now know, forget the date stuff, just the attorney general lying to the public and the impact that could have. As an investigator, you would want to keep digging at this point to learn more.
I would absolutely. There's a couple things I would do. First of all, it would have never fucking got to the attorney general. If I was investigating the case, that bullshit would have never got to him, because I would have known the real deal, and I would have never put it before a grand jury that this kid got raped in the shower, that he saw him getting raped in the shower when that wasn't true. Back it up, though. If the Joe Turner calls whomever and they call whoever and they say, hey, Woody, need you to go take a look at this. You know what I'm doing? I'm going to fucking interview Sandusky. And he's not under arrest. I'm going to say, hey, look, when he get, you know, sure, we get this kind of bullshit all the time, but this is someone saying they saw this. Was there anything to it? And if I think he's lying to me, or I say, tell me the name, you know, say he's, oh yeah, I take showers with kid all the time. Tell us the name of the kid. I would have gone to the kid. The kid said, denied it also and said, no, yeah, we were in the shower together. We were just fucking horse playing. We weren't fucking, or he wasn't raping me. Then I would have had to let it go. It would have never got to a grand jury, but as an investigator, if the date was messed up because there was a hockey game going on, campus couldn't have been empty, whatever, that wouldn't have made a fuck to me. And that's the truth. I would have gone and investigated. I would have questioned them separately. And, you know, I would have done my job.
There are different ways of skinning the cat, but I think what we're aligned on, and I think it's the only thing really can be aligned on after one episode, is this thing stinks. There's your antenna are up. The attorney general is misrepresented in a very deliberate way, the evidence in the case, and that's impacting public opinion. And now,
yep,
as an investigator, I need to learn. I
agree with you on that, but I'm gonna tell you something. That bitch would have never made that public release based off my investigation. If I've investigated, they told me the same thing. So we'll get into her at a later date. So that's, I don't want to lose the point of focus of this episode for me was the date and what he saw and when he told people or whatever. Later on, it's obviously proven this bitch is a liar. Maybe she's looking to run for governor, whatever it may be. That got out of hand. It's a lot of times, DAs will do it. They'll get this acute political emergency and like, holy fuck, this is a career maker, right? And then you run on it and you get tunnel vision and you can bend things in an investigation to fit your narrative. And is that obviously that's what she tried to do and they disproved it. So we agree upon that. And yeah, I know we went long and y'all and shit y'all, but you know, I think it was a good episode and I will do my homework for next week. And that's
it. Thank you. I'll send you the file. We'll post this one as well as the one for next week. So those of you that want to keep up with the discussion as we're going through it, you will be able to. Thanks for hanging in with us for almost an hour and a half today.
Another lifer posted a link to one of the end episodes, towards the end of the episodes in the podcast. It says, basically this sums everything up. If you just want to go listen to that, that's okay. But I would encourage you to do what I'm going to do, riding in a car, doing whatever I'm doing. I'm going to listen to these. And yes, you know, 2 hour podcast to me, I mean, I know this is over an hour. That's long as fuck, but but break it down and listen to it in segments so you can understand what Mike and I are agreeing or disagreeing about, arguing and not arguing about, whatever you want to call it. But at this point, you know, I think it was good. I understand your point. I think you understand my point. You may not like it, and I may not like yours. Actually, I don't have any problem with yours at this point. Everything you said has been correct, except for from an investigator standpoint, the date shit doesn't make a fuck to me.
I think that as more comes out over time, you may shift a little bit on that. You may not, but I think you will. But so right. We'll see. But anyway,
so, folks, hey, I'm going to tell you this.
Woody, thanks a ton for doing this.
I got to interrupt one more time because I get fired up about shit. I'm going to tell you something. There's shit coming up this is nothing. This date episode, that's not nothing. But there's shit coming up in this case that it's glad. I'm glad Ago and I are in different cities recording this because we probably going to end up in a fucking fist fight. But, and that's just the truth. This is nothing compared to what's coming. And I feel very strongly about some things that I know he does also, but y'all listen to it. And I go, we should probably do our own fucking podcast about this. But anyway, all right. Love y'all.
Thanks, folks. We'll talk back at you on Friday.
All right. Peace.
Do you want to peace out, Woody? Okay. Thanks.
Peace. Atlas. Yeah. Yeah.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.